the theme song from Mission Impossible, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to think about spies and intelligence, because we're going to be talking with a career CIA agent, field officer, Claire Lopez. We're going to ask her about her views on Afghanistan and the pod there, now that President Joe Biden has led this withdrawal from Afghanistan. And we want to look at what continuing threats there will be from jihadists in Afghanistan. And we want to talk to Claire Lopez, who has become an expert in the recent decades since 9/11 and September 11th, 2001, on the threat of jihad. Well, Claire Lopez, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, just starting out here, do you think, did President Joe Biden make the right decision in withdrawing American forces from Afghanistan?
I think that over the last 20 years, no president has actually identified the enemy that we are supposedly fighting in Afghanistan or actually taken the fight to that enemy per se. The enemy are the forces of Islamic Jihad, and nobody ever says that. So if you're not going to name the enemy, you're not going to fight the enemy, you're not going to take out the enemy's source of funding, which is the opium trade, never touched. If you're not going to knock out the top warlords who are leading the forces of the enemy, if you're not going to do any of that, if you're going to promulgate for the Afghans a 2004 constitution written together by a team from the Department of State, headed by Zalmay Khalilzad, ambassador, and others like Noah Feldman, protege at Harvard University of then dean at Harvard University, Elena Kagan, now on the Supreme Court. And that constitution of 2004 puts the entire country under Islamic law, then were our troops doing there anyway?
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point. Andrew McCarthy at National Review has brought that up, that both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, particularly with the advice of people like Noah Feldman from Harvard Law School, that we instituted what he's called these sort of Sharia-like constitutions. He's written specifically about the Afghan constitution, noted that if you go through it, as you indicated, it's just chock-a-block full of all of these Islamic Sharia references. I mean, you know, like Sharia is the basis for law, and there's a repugnancy clause that nothing in Afghanistan's legislation, its government, can be repugnant to Islam, can counter Islam, and, you know, Islam's a state religion, and you know, we had the over the years we had it was noted that the last Christian church in Afghanistan was destroyed in, like, if I recall correctly, like 2009, and you had that individual around the same period who converted to Christianity, and he ultimately had to flee for his life to Italy and receive asylum there because he was facing the death penalty in Afghanistan. So you have this constitution that now the Taliban, now that they're back in power, all they have to do is say, yeah, we want to implement Sharia, and we're going to do it the right way. So we're going to fulfill this constitution the way it should be done, and they can institute some sort of regime like in Iran, where they have so-called elections, but of course only people who support Sharia can run for office. What do you think? Could people have been debating this issue? Could Joe Biden or America have maintained any sort of check, any opposition to the Taliban with a regime supported by some minimal American support? I mean, we were down to something like 2,500 Americans there as advisors and sort of in technical roles. Could that have maintained itself to keep the Taliban from taking over the whole country?
Well, now we get to the question of the withdrawal itself and how it was executed, right? And during this past week's hearings on Capitol Hill in Congress, both the Senate and the House, their armed services, respective armed services committees, we learn from the set of clowns that lead our military, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and we heard from CENTCOM Commander Kenneth McKenzie. They all answered questions in both the House and the Senate. You know, we find out that they all recommended, apparently, to President Biden that 2,500 minimum American troops be left in Afghanistan, at least to secure Bagram Air Force Base and the gazillions of dollars of top-notch advanced American equipment and technology there at that base, and to ensure the safety of the withdrawal of American citizens, American green card holders, permanent residents, and our Afghan allies who worked with us before the military all fled the battlefield. But that's not how it was done.
Well, with yeah, indeed, right, as you've indicated, right.
You know, not only have we left behind who knows how many Americans and those with the special immigrant visa visas, you know, in their passports, and our Afghan allies, how many hundreds? We don't even know. They don't even know. And at the same time, we left behind over $80 billion, I think it might be $85 billion even, dollars worth of top American equipment, vehicles, aircraft, helicopters, et cetera, and smaller weapons too, which the Taliban was then seen parading through the streets and flying overhead in the wake of the American flight from the battlefield. Then there was the horrible suicide attack at Kabul Airport, for which they apparently had days worth of warning was coming, and then up until hours before warnings. Nevertheless, at the Abbott Gate, dozens and dozens of Afghan civilians were killed and 13 American service members as well, and others injured.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's been a total calamity. But do you think then that this could have been avoided by keeping a kind of status quo, steady as you go policy of trying to, again, with a minimal American support, some aid, you know, a few Americans, you could give this technological support to this Afghan government in Kabul and maintain a kind of a safe haven fire base, as it were, that you could strike out at the Taliban and any other jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda, and thereby, from such a rump position in Afghanistan, hold the Taliban and their allies in check?
I don't know. I certainly think that a force should have remained until all of our people were out and all of our equipment was either out or destroyed. That I think they should have done. But after 20 years, you know, the Taliban was advancing steadily. Sean Hannity on his Fox show shows this map of the advancing Taliban across Afghanistan beginning back in the spring or so, with the color red showing, you know, the provinces where the Taliban was taking over. And he goes back to like March or April of this year, 2021, and you know, he's showing that the advance was steady. Province after province after province was falling at the same time as, like during the past 20 years, our American feckless, incompetent, unqualified American leadership, not the troops. The troops are the best and the bravest in America. But the leadership continuously was telling Congress and the White House, oh, you know, just we're turning the corner. The Afghan army, they're just about there. You know, next week, they're going to be all on top of it. And it was all lies, of course, because, I mean, how do you get shiny stuff up on your shoulders? Combat and command. Well, there has to be combat to have combatant command, right? For 20 years, they managed to string this out, lying their way through the entire time. I don't know that we could have held off the Taliban much longer. I mean, after all, who are the Taliban? Yes, Taliban means students. They are the students that came out of the madrasas of the Pashtun areas that span the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, the Islamic schools. But who are the Taliban? They're the fathers, husbands, sons, and brothers of the Afghan people and of the Taliban, and of Pakistanis too. They were never, the Afghan people were never, ever going to support a bunch of infidel invaders, which is how they saw us, and our Western liberal democratic style of ideas, which they think are nothing but pure corruption of their way of life, which of course is primitive and savage and everything else, but 7th century. But that's how they looked at us, and that's how they look at the Taliban. So I don't think we could have held off the Taliban. Now, should we have kept, you know, a remnant holding on to Bagram Air Force Base, which was extremely important base for operations? Maybe Bagram, yeah, but that wouldn't have held off the Taliban from conquering the rest of the country or from taking Kabul itself, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then of course, then there's the strategic and tactical question. Well, how do you hold on to such a base like Bagram? You know, you're surrounded by the Taliban. If you can't really hold on to any part of the country with any sort of local coalition of the willing, any local partners, then you know, how would the United States hold on to, you know, just any strip? So that's the real quandary there.
Yeah, it is, and so what we're left with now is trying to operate in that area of Southwest or Central Asia from neighboring countries. And you know, who are the neighboring countries? Well, there's Iran, which has been in bed with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for decades. There's China on the other side, which is eyeing Bagram Air Force Base and rare earth elements in Afghanistan. There is Pakistan, whose intelligence service, the Inter-Service Directorate Intelligence Service, are the ones who actually created the Taliban, arm, support, train them to this day. And then to the north, you've got Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, maybe some possibilities there. And I will say that the Russians are not all that sanguine about what's going on. I mean, given their past experience in Afghanistan, they're not terribly excited to see the Taliban taking over the place. Now, of course, the Taliban didn't exist in the 1980s, but it's a lot of the same characters, a lot of the same players, nevertheless. So the Russians, particularly through Tajikistan, are playing things cautiously. So, you know, the surrounding neighborhood is not all that conducive to an American presence. So what, over the horizon, drone strikes that take 8 hours of flight just to get there, and then they, you know, incinerate a bunch of children? Maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has been an issue of discussion of if you don't have a base in Afghanistan like Bagram, you know, the possibilities of trying to control, you know, combat any threats in Afghanistan from outside the country are really limited. I mean, as you're indicating, you know, only maybe like Tajikistan or Uzbekistan might come into question for any sort of base. And you're saying drones, they take 8 hours to fly in from where, from Uzbekistan or Tajikistan?
You know, I don't know. Right now, I don't know. I don't think we have a very good presence in either one of those places right now, and obviously not in the others that I just mentioned. We're really out of real estate in that part of Southwest Asia. At the same time, I might note that the very same actors, malign actors, as before 9/11, I mean Iran, I mean Taliban, I mean Al-Qaeda, and today now, of course, with the addition of the Islamic State Khorasan, a presence there now that wasn't there before. And I would say also with the absence of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia under the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman thankfully, has taken a different path now. They are really doing behavior is completely different now than before 9/11, when they were part of the 9/11 conspiracy too. Today they're working behind the scenes to support the Abraham Accords, working with Israel. It's a completely different story with Saudi Arabia. So take them out of the equation, put Islamic State in the equation, and it's the same bunch of actors otherwise gathering once again in Afghanistan, which is going to be a magnet for jihadis all over the world once again. I can see China, for example, urging its Xinjiang population of Uyghurs, who've always fought with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, a bunch of jihadis is what they are. I can see China urging them, go ahead, go on over there. But don't you dare, lift a finger against China. I can see that happening. Magnet for jihadis, and they will come for us. Now, I don't know if they'll come for us again in the homeland or bases abroad, like military bases or diplomatic facilities. Any of that I think is possible, but they will come for us. They are obligated to under Islamic doctrine. Verse 839 of the Quran says, fight them until there is no more tumult, no more division, and all be for Allah alone. They take that very seriously. They think that is a direct, literal, word-for-word commandment from God. And they think they're going to hell for all eternity if they don't obey it. So they will obey it. And that's the danger that I see gathering in Afghanistan now. And I see all too little attention being paid that I can hear from any of our top leadership, the hapless military we spoke of earlier, Pentagon, Defense Department, or State Department, Secretary Antony Blinken, White House, National Security Council. I don't hear them talking about this at all. And yet I think that is what we need to be facing. That's the danger we need to be talking about and preparing for.
Yeah, I guess one thought that has occurred to me before is, it's sort of no surprise that Afghanistan would have been source of Al-Qaeda, its base for the 9/11 attacks and other attacks, and is now emerging again as a base, because I can't really think of any better place for a jihadist base in the world, because as you're indicating, it's so isolated in this rugged terrain.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that Afghanistan is going to be an even greater danger than, say, people have made comparisons to Sudan in the past, where Osama bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda members also were once based, or Yemen has certain dangers today with Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I mean, is Afghanistan really the top jihad base in the world? If you really want to have a source of jihad, that's the place you'd want to go.
Yeah, I think you're making a good point right there. Sudan, of course, is also turning a corner after the ouster of decades-long dictator Umar al-Bashir, who was Muslim Brotherhood at the time that he hosted the jihad jamboree, as I call it, of the early 1990s, that brought al-Qaeda, well, it wasn't al-Qaeda then, but it was forming, it was coalescing, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, their fighters, together with all the other jihadis of the world, PLO, PFLP, and people forget this, but Hezbollah and the entire top ranks of the Iranian government at the time. That's what Sudan did then. Umar al-Bashir was ousted, I don't know, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, and Sudan is now, northern Sudan, that is, we're talking about here, Khartoum. Not such a hospitable place for either Islamic State or Hamas, as I'm reading lately. So, yeah, you're right. Afghanistan might be one of the, if not the best redoubt for jihadis in the world right now.
Well, you mentioned earlier criticizing strategy in Afghanistan. You say that we didn't target the warlords supporting this, or for that matter, the opium trade. I mean, I've heard before that one of the goals that the American-led coalition had pursued was indeed opium eradication. How would you have done those two things differently, targeting opium and targeting leadership, as you're talking about? How is that not done right?
As I understand it, what our forces did was try to eradicate fields of opium poppies growing with, herbicides or whatever they sprayed. And that did nothing except put the small farmer out of business. However, the warlords who are bankrolled by the opium trade, were left untouched, mostly, not all. I mean, they knocked off a few of them, but mostly. And in particular, because some of those warlords, like a Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, for example, have their villas, their compounds on the Pakistani side of the border where they're protected. And I don't know if folks know this, but opium, when it's harvested, you know, it's cut at the stem, you can stash that for a long, long time, and it doesn't degrade. It doesn't rot away. So it becomes kind of like your bank account. And when the warlords need to, fund some more jihadis or buy some more weapons, they go sell a bunch of opium. And that was never touched. Their stashes weren't touched. Their villas weren't touched. I'm sorry if there's some goats running around the yard. Those villas should have been flattened and the warlords themselves taken out. The other thing is that we knew the opium trafficking routes, two major ones. One went south through Pakistan, and the other went westward through Iran. And yes, the Iranian government, I should say regime, and its IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, Intelligence Service, are all to this day up to their eyeballs in that opium trade going westward through Iran and out, you know, through waterways to other customers. So we left that be. We didn't touch that. Now, one of the considerations that may have been at play here is that how were our own troops and people in Afghanistan supplied during these all 20 last years? Well, yes, through Bagram, but that's expensive and air flights could not handle all of the supplies that were needed. How were most of them brought in? By truck convoy overland up from the port of Karachi, Pakistan, up through the length or width, whatever, length of Pakistan, up through the Khyber Pass and into Afghanistan. That means that our people in Afghanistan have always been hostages of the jihad regime in Islamabad, which any time it wanted to send a message would just unleash one of its proxy terror groups like Lashkar-e-Jangvi or Lashkar-e-Taiba or one of them, Jaish-e-Mohammed, to attack the convoys, to attack the truck convoys. So we were hostage. I mean, we were literally hostage to the jihadi Pakistani regime and the ISI. That may have been a consideration. I suspect it was a rather large one.
Yeah, that's another issue that's been discussed in the past about this Pakistan frenemy, as it's called, this friend enemy, you know, playing a double game, actually more perhaps, as I've heard say to me before, an aid worker had been in Pakistan and said, yeah, that's a small FR and a big ENEMY, you know, it's really, they're really under the cover more against us than they're for us. And so that only brings into further play, you know, the problems of trying to conduct any military strategy in Afghanistan, that you have this Pakistan that's really not on your side, is really offering safe haven to the Taliban and these warlords and their drug trade, and can indeed hold your entire effort there hostage. So what do you think policy should be towards Pakistan now that we've pulled out of Afghanistan? What sort of fundamental reevaluation would you advocate there?
Well, certainly honesty about who and what they are. I mean, for example, after 9/11, as al-Qaeda was ousted from the country, from Afghanistan, you know, the leadership and the fighters went fleeing in different directions, right? Some went to that mountainous region between Afghanistan and Pakistan to hide out. a whole bunch, including bin Laden, his fighters and families, went westward into Iran, where they stayed from late 2001 into mid-2010, when they moved to Abbottabad, Pakistan, and 1 year later, our Special Operations Forces found them there. But the third major group that fled Afghanistan, led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, then number two, now number one, went to Quetta. Quetta is a city in Pakistan, and they've been there ever since. We got to be honest about this stuff. It's never been openly discussed. And again, okay, perhaps because of that, you know, hostage situation due to the supply chain. But now, okay. But yeah, can we really expect, you know, this kind of open, honest discussion from this current administration of ours that is absolutely permeated with Muslim Brotherhood associates and affiliates? I mean, the main liaison at the National Security Council between the intelligence community of the United States and the White House is a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate. His name is Maher Bitar. Comes out of the American Muslims for Palestine and Students for Justice in Palestine out of the campus of Georgetown University, which are Muslim Brotherhood organizations. Got a Muslim brother, key node of our National Security Council. What kind of, you know, operations can we expect? What kind of honesty? What kind of openness? Probably none.
Yeah. Just thinking of Pakistan there again, as others have noted, it, you know, just sort of makes the situation seem even more hopeless. A good book to read on this. I did a book review of this once years ago for Jihad Watch. It's called Jihad as Grand Strategy, which looks at the history of Pakistan and how they've used jihadist proxies like the Taliban today, precisely as a part of Pakistani national security strategy, particularly with respect to India, to keep India off balance and, you know, supporting Lashkar-e-Taiba and its attacks on say, Mumbai in November 26, 2008, and in Kashmir, and then seeking also Afghanistan to be a kind of a satellite of Pakistan for sort of a rear area. So this has been something that's been going on in Pakistan since its independence during Indian partition in 1947. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to see how America can really accomplish anything in Afghanistan when it really is indeed going up against the fundamental interests of this large neighbor next door, Pakistan.
Well, I think you've just put your finger on a very important point, and that is that our natural best ally in that region is now and has been India, which is a representative-style, liberal, Western democratic-style country. Governed by a very astute leader right now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. By the way, under whose leadership they have absolutely crushed the China virus. They don't have it anymore, but that's another story. But India will definitely become even more, if that's possible, a target for the jihadis out of both Pakistan and Afghanistan now that the Taliban control all of Afghanistan, or most of Afghanistan, but we should be renewing and strengthening our ties with India. Now, of course, we and India, Japan, and Australia are members of what's called the Quad, the four-nation alliance there, but I would see this as a time for strengthening those ties with India.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking at the other countries surrounding Afghanistan, I mean, you mentioned China. What sort of relationship do you think China will develop with Afghanistan? I mean, you talk about the mineral resources. There's been talk about, China doesn't really care about, say, jihadist threats as long as you say, it's away from China or whatever the Taliban does. I mean, they certainly don't care about human rights abuse. So, you know, there you could see the Taliban in power in Afghanistan and China have very profitable relationship. I mean, China could pursue a lot of business interests, and then Taliban could get a lot of aid. And, you know, with the Uyghurs, as you mentioned, there'd be sort of an interesting parallel there that as you've indicated in the past, Saudi Arabia has had a similar pattern where they've said, yeah, if you want to be a jihadist and get martyrdom, go blow yourself up. Okay, fine. Just don't do it in Saudi Arabia. Just get out of the country. Go to Afghanistan. Go somewhere else. You know, go fight infidels there. You know, and that's fine. So you're saying that, you know, China could do a similar thing with the Uyghurs.
I don't know that. I'm speculating on that, but I could see that happening. But to the broader question of the Chinese developing relationship now with the Taliban, you know, they're going to be cautious. They're not going to get themselves bogged down like either the Russians or we did. They're going to approach it with a cold mercantilist eye, if you will. What they want will be perhaps the post of Bagram Air Force Base. I can see them negotiating some kind of a deal to get themselves a presence there, but not much more than that in terms of a presence. And eventually down the line at some point, yeah, they're going to want to exploit the rare earth elements, rare earth minerals that Afghanistan is rich in, such as lithium and other things. But it'll be strictly a mercantilist deal. You know, they're shrewd, these leadership figures in Beijing, and they're not going to get themselves all tied down the way we did in Afghanistan.
Well, yeah, indeed, yeah. As I was indicating, they'll try to engage in really kind of sort of bargain between two devils, I guess you could call it. Of wheeling and dealing, you know, giving Taliban aid and in turn getting whatever interest they want out of Afghanistan. So a mutually beneficial relationship among two rather nefarious actors. Well, you discussed Iran before. What particular relationship would the Islamic Republic of Iran have to Afghanistan? I mean, we're talking about, again, a Shiite-dominated jihadist regime in Iran. Dealing with a majority Sunni country and Sunni forces in the Taliban in Afghanistan. What sort of particular advantages might Iran look for in Afghanistan?
Well, remember, the 9/11 attacks did not come out of the Hindu Kush. They came out of Tehran and Beirut and Riyadh. They didn't really come out of Afghanistan. Yes, those were the cannon fodder. They were the foot soldiers. But that's not where the plot came from. The plot came out of Iran, which worked very closely with the Taliban and with al-Qaeda in the years leading up to 9/11. Fun fact here, real quick. When President Obama released five detainees out of Gitmo back some years in exchange with the Haqqani Network for the U.S. Army deserter traitor Bo Bergdahl, one of those released was a name I can barely pronounce, but I'll try. It's Hirola Hirakawa. I'm sorry, but it's a lot of K-H's and W's. Anyway, if you look it up, you'll see the name that I mean. And why was he in Gitmo to begin with? Well, that particular individual had been the governor of Herat province, the westernmost province of Afghanistan, before 9/11. And his job in those years, 1999, 2000 into 2001, was to coordinate meetings among the Iranians, IRGC, Quds Force, and MOIS, that's the intelligence service, the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden. That's what his job was. That's what he did. That's why he wound up in Gitmo. Well, he got released. He goes immediately to Doha, Qatar, to join the surrender talks between the U.S., Zalmay Khalilzad, leading our surrender side, and the Taliban that went on there for years in Doha. And now, guess where he is? Guess where Khairullah Khairkhawa, I'm sorry, slaughtering the name, but guess where he is right now? He is in the cabinet of the Taliban in Kabul. Okay, this is the kind of thing that gives me pause about the role of Iran now. It's always been a kind of I don't know, an up and a down kind of a relationship between Iran and the Taliban. And the Western media and the Western governments like ours, clueless ones, always like to highlight the low points and the points of friction. And there have been points of friction, obviously. But they never talk about the collaboration for 9/11. I don't know why, but they don't. So I think that Iran is treading cautiously right now with the Taliban. But remember, too, Iran's Shiite terror proxy, Hezbollah, has been in Afghanistan training the Taliban since well before 9/11, and they continue to do so to this day. People don't talk about that either. I don't know why. But, yeah, keep an eye on that relationship. I don't trust either of them, Taliban or the Iranian regime.
Yeah, but so you're indicating that much of the planning is for 9/11. I mean, there's often been discussed in the past that Iran, you know, gave a free passage and safe haven to Al-Qaeda leaders. So you're saying that, you know, much of the planning for 9/11 actually took place among Al-Qaeda leaders in Iran.
Yes, although what I'll say is that the plot for an airplane, a civilian airliner attack against buildings in the West, in America, that goes all the way back to the Ayatollah Khomeini, 1988, the year before he died. They called the plot the Boeing plot. How I know this is that I was an expert witness in a legal case. The legal case was called Havlish versus Bin Laden or something et al. Excuse me. You can find the documents for this case online if you want to look them up. www.iran911case.com. The affidavit for that case that I co-authored with friend and colleague Bruce Teft can be found at the Exhibits tab. Exhibit number 6 is ours. It's the history of the Iran Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah relationship. So the plot begins with Khomeini. Now, it never came to fruition. He died. The successor as supreme leader is today's, to this day, is the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He picks up the plot. And as I said before, mentioning about the jihad jamboree that Omar al-Bashir convened in Khartoum, that is when the Iranian leadership got together physically for the first time, and Hezbollah with Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and their other fighters. The entire top leadership, I mean, this, I can't emphasize how important this is. It's to be found in the 9/11 Commission report, but only a brief mention. The president of Iran, Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani at the time, came to Khartoum to meet bin Laden. The head of the Iranian intelligence service at the time, Ali Falahian, he came. The head of the IRGC at the time, Mohsen Rezai, he came. And the top terror chieftain of Hezbollah, Imad Mughniya, was in Khartoum for that meeting too. And subsequently, there were several meetings in the early 1990s. They were all there. The Iranian and the Hezbollah leadership were in Khartoum to meet with bin Laden. I can't emphasize that enough, and people don't seem to know this, including our own leadership and presidents. But what happened there at those meetings is that bin Laden turns to Rafsanjani and he says, "Hey, I really like what your Hezbollah boys do with big building attacks," meaning truck bombings, and referring back to the 1983 attacks against our Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, our embassy, also the French got hit. "Can you teach my boys how to do that, suicide truck bombings against big buildings?" And Rafsanjani says, "Yeah, of course." And he says, Imad Mughniya, the terror chieftain of Hezbollah, come here. Set up training camps for Al-Qaeda. And that's what happened. Imad Mughniya set up training camps to teach Al-Qaeda how to do these suicide bombings in Sudan, in Iran, in Lebanon, maybe other places too. And what succeeded, what came after that? 1996, Khobar Towers. 1998, East Africa embassy bombings. 2000, the USS Cole gets hit in port in Yemen. And then, of course, 9/11. All of that flowed from the initial meeting set up in Khartoum by Omar al-Bashir among Iran, Hezbollah, and al-Qaeda. Well, there wasn't an al-Qaeda, as I've said before, but it was forming. It was coalescing. Usama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri et al. That all flowed from those meetings. Who recruited? Who actually went physically into Saudi Arabia in late 2000 and early 2001 to personally recruit the 15 of 19 hijackers, eventually who were Saudi? Imad Mughniyeh did that. Imad Mughniyeh. Yes, it had to be with a minimum of acquiescence from the Saudi government, but that was on orders from Iran. Hezbollah just doesn't go do things willy-nilly by themselves like that. That was on orders from Iran to go recruit those hijackers. Then Imad Mughniyeh, Hezbollah terror chieftain, accompanies them on their flights all over the Middle East for their briefing and their training. A lot of the training took place in Iran, by the way, which acquired jet simulators out in the Far East, I think Malaysia, brought them back to Iran for them to begin their training in Iran on the simulators. This is all in our case. That's why I mentioned the Havlish case, Iran911.com, Iran911case.com. Anyway, that is just a brief overview of the Iran, al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah relationship that never gets talked about. I don't know why, again.
Wow, yeah, that's, I mean, I've heard of, I haven't studied the issue extensively, but I've heard of, you know, certainly of Iran giving safe passage and having links, but never such a really fully deep account like that of such extensive planning and aid for al-Qaeda. Well, looking at Afghanistan coming under the power of the Taliban again, this is an idea that goes back way before 9/11. People like Richard Clark and the Clinton administration has suggested arming the Northern Alliance against the Taliban, supporting them in Afghanistan. This collection of mostly, I guess, Tajik leaders and tribesmen in the northern part of Afghanistan as an opposition. Is there any possibility of doing something like that again? I mean, it was the Northern Alliance that helped the United States when we went in 2001 to quickly throw out the Taliban with American aid, air support, special forces, and now the son of Ahmed Shah Massoud, who was assassinated by Al-Qaeda 2 days before 9/11, is now trying to lead the Northern Alliance again. Is there any possibility of developing such an opposition to the Taliban like that again?
Well, that opposition very much is real. It is operating in the Panjshir Valley, which was the center of Ahmed Shah Massoud's opposition to the Taliban. And by the way, it wasn't al-Qaeda that took out Ahmed Shah Massoud. That plot was an Iranian plot. The Iranians recruited the Belgian camera crew that came in to interview Ahmed Shah Massoud and blew themselves up in a suicide bombing and killed him too, days before 9/11. That was an Iranian plot. Why? Because Ahmed Shah Massoud, as the head of the Northern Alliance at that time, they knew that we would come for them after 9/11. They knew that America would come to Afghanistan and that Ahmed Shah Massoud and the Northern Alliance would be our staunch allies in that case, and they needed to take him out. Well, yes, now the son, Ahmed Massoud, is, along with, by the way, the former vice president of the Iran, of the Afghan government, Amrullah Saleh. I guess he now is called the president or president-elect, I guess, of Afghanistan or something like that. In any case, he is with Ahmed Massoud and others. I thought I had seen that the Panjshir Valley had been, cleaned out by the Taliban. I'm not sure how much of a resistance remains there or elsewhere in Afghanistan, but I've also heard statements coming out of our own State Department, you know, to the effect that they have no inclination whatsoever to help them. I mean, naturally, whose side are they on anyway?
Mm-hmm. Well, why is, I guess I've never quite specifically understood, why did this Northern Alliance in the Panjshir Valley, I mean, Ahmad Shah Massoud was known as the Lion of Panjshir. Why did they oppose the Taliban initially or still do today? Is it just merely a sort of a tribal difference that these are mainly Tajiks, whereas the Taliban have their base of support among the dominant Pashto population of Afghanistan?
Yeah, that's a large part of it. But it's also that they didn't want to be dominated by the Pashtun, but by their extremely faithful, devout, strict observance of Islamic law. I think those other tribal groupings like the Tajiks and the Uzbeks, certainly the Hazara, who are Shiite, did not want to be placed under the absolute strict enforcement of Sharia as the Taliban was enforcing it. So it's certainly tribal. It's certainly ethnic, definitely. But it's also a difference in how strictly they wanted to observe Islamic law.
Well, that then raises an interesting question. I mean, looking back at 2001, you know, of course, with this American aid of air power and so forth on some special forces, I mean, the Taliban fell really quickly in the face of groups like the Northern Alliance. Could the Taliban then ever become really unpopular in Afghanistan and then be subject to yet again another overthrow if America were to give aid to a group like the Northern Alliance?
Well, I certainly expect to see another outbreak of ethnic tribal civil war in Afghanistan, much as followed the 1980s war in Afghanistan when all, you know, the Russian troops left, excuse me, and what was left, you know, were these warring ethnic groups. And it was in the early 1990s that the horrific civil war in Afghanistan among these various tribal and ethnic groups, warlords, tore Afghanistan apart, bombarded the cities, horrific civilian casualties. That's what actually gave rise to the Taliban in the first place. If we recall, what happened is that the Pakistani ISI, again, saw an opportunity, recruited the students out of the madrasas, trained them, armed them, and sent them in to quell the civil war fighting in Afghanistan, to bring order, to stop the slaughter. That is how the Taliban got started, and this is about the mid-1990s. Well, I can see the same kind of civil war erupting once again, but, you know, who's to say who will stop it? You know, who will put an end to it this time? I don't know.
Well, that's an argument that people have brought up before, is that, you know, the Taliban took control in 1996, and that there was then a sense of, well, yeah, maybe, you know, well, maybe the Taliban are somewhat harsh, or, you know, people might quibble over its particular implementation of Islamic law. Heck, you know, we've got order now, and we've got, it might be somewhat harsh, but it's order. So, you know, many Afghans will just go along with that. I mean, they you know, they're Muslim, they sympathize with Islam and Islamic norms. So, you know, they'll at least go along with the Taliban. But so could that happen again, that the Taliban could
stabilize?
Yeah, I mean,
a lot of them mm-hmm. will. And again, just as you say, the Pashtun are the largest ethnic group, tribal ethnic group in Afghanistan, and of course spanning the border over into Pakistan. But there are a lot of other ethnic groups and tribes and clans. We've mentioned the Tajiks and the Uzbeks. I mentioned the Hazaras, which are, they're Shiite, and so many others that are smaller in number even maybe, but, you know, they don't want any part of the Taliban. So, It's a toss-up at the moment, and I hate to see it, but I think absolute chaos is going to be coming to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. No, so you think really it will be a repeat of that civil war in the 1990s after the Soviets pulled out?
I can see that erupting, yeah, absolutely. But how mm-hmm. it'll be settled this time, I don't know. Maybe the Taliban, with all of its nifty new American equipment, will prevail, huh?
Well, would then Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, neighboring Afghanistan, would they have an interest then in supporting their brethren in Afghanistan against the Taliban? And would that be an opportunity?
Yeah. No, they might. They might. And indeed, Tajikistan, as I understand it already, is providing at a minimum safe haven to people fleeing the Taliban in Afghanistan right now. Mm-hmm. And the Russians, who have a strong interest in these Central Asian republics too, seem to be okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes you think, the United States, of course, we supported this Mujahideen fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. I guess, we could sort of repeat the process and now support, Northern Alliance, Tajiks, Uzbeks, and others, into try to overthrow the Taliban. I mean, everyone always has troubles, as people have noted, trying to bring any sort of central rule to Afghanistan. I mean, whether it was the Soviets
yeah.
or then
I mean,
us
it's not
in
a
America.
Country, right? It's not really a country. It's a jigsaw puzzle of warring ethnic groups that mutually hate each other. It's not a country. It never,
right.
In ancient times, Britain was a patchwork of warring Celts and Anglos and Saxons, but they came together and they've been a unified nation for, hundreds of years. Afghanistan never did that. There's still a jigsaw puzzle of warring ethnic groups, and they've never, ever reconciled or found some central, reason to unify. It's not a country. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. And the United States, under the current administration anyway, seems to have absolutely no interest not only in getting our people out who are still stuck in there hostage, but in doing anything about the complete collapse of the country into utter chaos.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's never been any united Afghanistan like eventually what formed in the United Kingdom with Scotland, Wales, and England, and, well, for that matter, Ireland, or now Northern Ireland coming together. So, yeah, that's it'll certainly be a much longer process for Afghanistan to ever reach any such stage. We've talked about all these difficulties and just enormous challenges. I mean, making it almost impossible to pursue any such strategy of trying to create some sort of stable regime in Afghanistan that would be anti-jihadist. Why did it take so long for anyone to recognize this? I mean, why didn't we course long before these sort of 20 years of a failure, you could call it? I mean, you mentioned the sort of careerism you've talked about, that, people want to rise to the ranks so that they would have an interest of just sort of, muddling through, continuing a war to have their career advance by getting military experience. So that why did this take so long before, for 20 years before, people started to say, look, we need a fundamental rethink here?
Well, I think part of the reason has to do with the same reasons why nobody has ever named, identified, or gone after the Muslim Brotherhood in America. The Muslim Brotherhood dominates our foreign policy, even some domestic policy decisions, certainly regarding the Islamic world, certainly regarding places in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and they ensured that generation after generation of rising officers in the diplomatic corps, the intelligence services, and the military of the United States were systematically, deliberately denied any understanding, training, teaching, education about Islam, jihad, and Sharia. And that persists to this day. The Muslim Brotherhood and its front groups in America have been incredibly successful at suppressing any kind of teaching, training, instruction about Islam and what it is. What is jihad? What is Sharia? How did we come to write such a horrific constitution for the Afghans? They've been successful at that, and to this day now, it, like I said, generation after generation, any officer in the U.S. diplomatic, intelligence, or military services who've risen to rank since 9/11 systematically has been deprived of any such understanding, teaching, training, instruction. I mean, people who were experts and at one point before 9/11 were teaching and training, maybe a little bit after, our senior military, our government, our national security people, Steve Coughlin, Robert Spencer, Bill Gothrop, John Guandolo, go on and on down the list. They've all been banned for the last 20 years of teaching who is the enemy. What is it that we are supposedly fighting in Afghanistan? Well, this is the result.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking at now with this withdrawal, you know, we have Afghan refugees coming here. You've talked about, you know, the need to get these special immigrant visa holders out of Afghanistan to flee these Taliban ravages. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, there's a question of vetting here. Whom exactly are we bringing in? And we've had issues of now sexual assaults on military bases that are like Fort Bliss and so forth. Do you see any problems developing with these various Afghan refugees coming into the United States and other countries?
Oh, yeah. I see huge problems. And I don't mean just the recent news, like you're talking about, the sexual assaults on the military bases, the old men coming in with three and four little girls they call their wives. That is called child trafficking, human trafficking, polygamy. These things are illegal in the United States. We're aiding and abetting violation of U.S. law right there. But here's the other part of it. You're talking about vetting. Absolutely spot on. We don't vet these people. I mean, we all saw the videos of, you know, hordes of Afghans rushing the planes on the tarmac at Kabul Airport. But it's not just that. Even those who ostensibly were, air quotes, vetted, did anyone ever ask a single one of them, do you here and now abjure any loyalty to any other legal system, including Islamic law, and pledge allegiance only to the Judeo-Christian-based American Constitution? Do you or don't you? Nobody ever asks questions like that because I guess that's Islamophobic or something. But that would be, I mean, that would be where I would start. Can you be, a good addition to the American population? Can you be someone who will be here blend into American society with allegiance to our constitutional foundational documents and everything written in them? Of course they can't. They would never ask such a question. None of them would be here if they asked that question. And I've also asked this question on other programs. Is the advance team for the next 9/11 already on U.S. soil? I don't think that's a crazy question to ask.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, it's important to remember that, of course, the Pulse nightclub shooter, if I call correctly, teen in Orlando, Florida, was the son of an Afghan immigrant, of course, apparently someone who had run for president of Afghanistan or something. So, yeah, so
yeah,
you've got to...
Omar Mateen's father was closely affiliated with the Taliban. Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so...
The imam in his mosque was Pakistani.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me there's no Pakistani ISI involvement there, or in San Bernardino for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Their names, Tashfeen, I forget their names, but Farouk. Anyway, they the wife in that massacre in 2016. No, that was 2015, and Florida was 2016. I think it's like that. In any case,
okay.
That massacre in San Bernardino, she, the wife in that case, Tashfeen Malik had studied at university in the Punjab for something like 6 or 7 years, prime recruiting ground for the Pakistani ISR or Lashkar-e-Taiba, Lashkar-e-Jangvi, their terror proxies. Tell me there is no Pakistani ISI involvement there either. Nobody ever looked at that. Nobody ever talked about it.
Well, very interesting, very troubling for our listeners out there. You've been hearing another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we've been talking with former career CIA agent, field officer Claire Lopez on Afghanistan and the future of jihad. Well, Claire, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. That was a great discussion.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. And for our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.